Welcome to the Commonwealth Club. I'm George Hammond, chair of the Humanities Forum, which organized tonight's event. I'd like to welcome our live audience here in San Francisco and our radio and online audiences. It's my pleasure to introduce Marty Brownstein again. He came and spoke here a couple of years ago, 4 years ago, yeah. And we wanted to bring him back, an always timely topic. So our speaker today brings us a true interfaith story of courage, compassion, and rescue, service to others to its highest degree. It's conveyed through his book, Two Among the Righteous Few, A Story of Courage in the Holocaust. The lessons and values of this story are important for our lives today. In fact, sharing this story has put Marty on quite a journey, which is now in its sixth year. This journey has had him speaking in a wide variety of venues throughout his home base of the San Francisco Bay Area and a dozen other cities around the country as well. Interestingly enough, this book was not always Marty's normal work. For 25 years, he led a management consulting firm serving a wide variety of clients across many industries on issues of leadership and organizational effectiveness. Through this work, he has written 8 business management-related books from contributing author to sole author, including Communicating Effectively for Dummies, Coaching and Mentoring for Dummies, and Managing Teams for Dummies. His 9th book, the focus of this presentation, is quite different and special. It takes Marty back to his early career as an educator when he was teaching history, including the Holocaust. In addition, this true and remarkable story has a meaningful personal connection, which Marty will reveal in his engaging storytelling presentation. Books will be available after the lecture. Please give a warm welcome to Marty.
Thank you very much. Good evening, everyone. Let me try that again. Good evening, everyone. Now, because get ready, I'm going to take you on a journey into a remarkable story tonight. And to start this journey, I want you to be thinking about 3 questions. Question number 1, would you be willing to help others whose lives are in great danger? Think about that for a moment. It's actually a tough question. Question 2, would you be willing to help others whose lives are in great danger? Knowing if you get involved, you probably put your life in great danger. Would you still help? And question 3, would you be willing to help others whose lives are in great danger? Knowing if you get involved, you probably put your life in great danger. When these people who most need the help, most everybody else wants to hate them or be indifferent to their plight, would you still get involved and help? And as you see up here, the book, Two Among the Righteous Few, A Story of Courage in the Holocaust, is a true story of a Christian couple that answered a definite yes to all 3 of those questions in a time period when most everybody else said no. This couple was a Christian couple from the Netherlands. We'll go to the next slide to introduce you to them now. Franz and Mien Weinacker. And this is a picture of them at the end of World War II. And in brief, who were they? Next slide, please. And that's who they were. You see the top line about ordinary people. That's it. There was nothing special about them. No great success in business, no inventions to their name. If you went in the Netherlands today and traveled around any of the major cities, and you went up to Dutch citizens and said, please tell me about Franz and Mien Weinacker, most would say this, well, I don't know who they are. But that second line, about doing extraordinary things, at a certain point in their life, they're going to do such extraordinary things that teaches us lessons for our lives today. And as we go to the next slide to see them again here, what I'm going to do tonight in my storytelling presentation, I'm going to first paint a little historical picture behind this story, a little bit about World War II in Europe, the Holocaust, and life in the Netherlands during World War II when it was under Nazi Germany occupation, the worst of all the countries in Western Europe. That picture I'll paint first will help you understand when I talk about who they were and what they end up doing that later will earn them a heroic honor. You're going to see how remarkable and unusual that was. And the last thing that I'll mention in my presentation here, as mentioned in the introduction, is I also have a very meaningful personal connection to the story and its heroes. But I always save that for last, and then we'll take a few minutes of your questions, and yes, books available afterwards for just 15 if you want to come up and visit. But let me do a quick pause before I get into that. I feel appreciative that I'm able to come back to the Commonwealth Club here 4 years later and share this story. Thank you tonight to George Hammond, who welcomed me back here. Please give him a hand for that. This is actually a story I stumbled into by accident on a trip to the Netherlands with my wife in May of 2009. Never would have expected writing a book about this couple, and nor would have expected what's happened since. This has sent me on a widespread journey. I've been now well into 6 years with this journey, and I speak in a variety of venues, from workplaces to book discussions now in schools, to places of faith, variety of service organizations, and so many others in between. Tonight, in 6 years here, this is event number 545. As my wife will remind me sometimes, it's taken over our lives. But I get to be the humble messenger of these two heroes. And what's helped this journey, a few of you were asking me before this, I've had people become supporters on the journey. I have a little support list. People often will sign up on it just to keep in touch, spread the word when I have things come up. I've had supporters, though, that have actually not only spread the word, but they've actually connected me or been hosts for some of the events I've had in that 545. Tonight, I see at least three of them in this audience. I want to say a special thank you to, from the City of San Francisco Park and Rec Department, Lorraine Banford. Thank you very much. Please give her a hand. Friend and former client, Carol Beatty, back there, also a San Franciscan. Thank you. Can you wave your hand, Carol, so everyone can see who you are. And up front here, a wonderful doctor as well, Elizabeth Lister. Thank you for coming tonight. So that's what's kept this journey going. I hope some of you will become those supporters as I get to be the humble messenger for these two heroes. Now I'm going to get you into the story, and we'll see what you know about your history. I'll throw out a few questions. Guesses are welcomed. Don't have to worry whether it's right or not. And by the way, if it is correct, see George for prizes afterwards here. So my first question, I said the story takes place during World War II in Europe. When does World War II in Europe begin and where?
September 1st in Poland.
What year?
In Poland, 1939.
Very good, very good. A country has invaded Poland, as she has said, in September 1st of 39. What country invaded Poland there? Germany. And the other powers of Europe at that time, Britain and France, declared war against Germany 2 days later because of that invasion. World War II breaks out. And the Poles were very excited because they thought, yay, the British and French are going to help us against those nasty Germans. And they didn't. By the end of September, Poland had fallen. And the war stopped for a period of time. In fact, if you looked at newspaper headlines around the world over the next 6 months, a headline you would sometimes see was this, phony war. I guess this war must not be real because Britain and France said they're going to attack Germany. And they sat there. But this war will not stay quiet with just a few countries involved. By spring of 1940, it starts erupting in Europe and keeps erupting and erupting and finally ends in Europe when? When does the war finally end in Europe? May of 1945, it ends in Europe. August of 45, when Japan and Asia surrendered, it's finally done worldwide. So this war takes the first half of the decade of the 1940s. And when it was finally done, over 5+ years, and still true today with all wars that came before it and all wars that have come since, this is the most destructive war in humankind's history by far. When it was finally over, you ended up with over 60 countries committing troops into this awful war, billions of dollars of property damage worldwide, and over 50 million people are going to die worldwide in this awful war, the most by far ever. And one thing that we saw in this war that we had not seen to the full extent in wars prior, much more common sense. More than half of that 50 million figure are going to be civilians. So it's not just soldiers dying at a high rate. And that was especially true if you lived on the continent of Europe. Nearly 2/3 of the death and destruction this awful war takes place throughout all of Europe. Every country there was terribly impacted for 5+ years. For the average citizen of Europe, your life was basically a nightmare trying to survive. And that's where Franz Armin Weinacker lived. You don't want to be there. Now, Holocaust, capital H, the event, is also part of this story. Its beginnings actually start before World War II begins, 1933. And its origins start in what country? Where does it begin, the Holocaust? What country?
Germany
is where it begins. That's right. And at the start of 1933, Germany, by the way, this always frightens me when I explain it, was actually a democracy. And through the democratic process, this man gets appointed to the position of chancellor, like prime minister. And a short time after coming into that position, he creates excuses to throw democracy out the window in Germany. One-party dictatorship rule takes over, and the persecution that becomes part of the Holocaust begins right away. Of course, who am I talking about? That's right. But the Holocaust will not just stay in Germany. Before the war breaks out in September of 1939, it's already spread into Austria, then into Czechoslovakia, and then when the war breaks out in September of 1939, it will eventually spread throughout all of Europe, into North Africa, and finally ends when? When does the Holocaust finally end? With the end of World War II. That's right. May of 45, when World War II in Europe ended, the Holocaust ended. Two separate events that are basically going on simultaneous tracks. The Holocaust, when it was finally done after 12 years, this was a systematic and racist effort to persecute, isolate, and then mass murder millions of people on Adolf Hitler's list of so-called undesirables or inferiors. And when it's finally over, you're going to see over 11 million people murdered in the Holocaust. And as most of you probably know, number one target on the list was whom? There are going to be 6 million out of that. That number, three-fourths of the population in the Bay Area today, frightening when you think about it, it started in 1933 in Europe. There was nearly 2 out of every 3 European Jew that will not be alive by May of 1945. By the way, of the other 5 million plus victims in the Holocaust, who were some of them? Gypsies, good, keep going. Homosexuals, very good, keep going. Say again? The few that may have been there. There wasn't much Mormon population in Europe at that point. Yes, people with disabilities, mentally, physical disabilities, people of Slavic heritage, which takes in a number of nationalities throughout parts of Europe. Non-Jewish Poles were the largest group out of that. And communist, political opponents, anybody who spoke out against this, you were viewed as a political dissident. It was a big list, Jews being the top target on that list. And if you're on that list during this time period, not only is your life a nightmare, it's doomed. And in most cases, you will be captured and deported, if not murdered, before you can ever figure out doom is coming. But in the 1930s, before World War II broke out, some people in Europe sensed doom was coming, and they were looking to get out. And if you sought the help of governments during this time period, because a refugee crisis now breaks out, and there were many governments that could have helped these refugees in dire need. Here's a few that could have helped most of all. You may have heard of them. Canada, Great Britain, the United States. How many governments were willing to help these refugees in dire need? Say that out loud, Joe. Now, we're not going to see much from governments. What you're going to see throughout this whole time period, there will only be a handful of people throughout all of Europe, let alone the world, that'll have the courage and compassion to say, this is wrong and I should try to help. Franz and Mean Weinacher were among those few, unfortunately. Now we're going to take you to their country. We'll go to the next slide. We'll go to the Netherlands. And there you see up on the slide here, the map of the country here. Now, again, if we had the bigger map of Europe, and I'll make a generalization, not true in every case, but Americans, if you haven't traveled to Europe, geography isn't our forte necessarily. And we can say, first one to find Holland on the map wins. It's a small country area-wise. You drive 3-4 hours in any direction, you've hit the whole country. You're still in Northern California. But it's densely populated. This is the most densely populated country in Europe today, nearly 17 million people. And at the time, just prior to the war starting, 9 million. And by the way, anybody here traveled to the Netherlands? Yes, yes, well, I figure you two have been there. Yes, yes, we have a couple from the Dutch consulate here today. Thank you for coming. Those who've traveled, here's the major city, Amsterdam, the largest city, basically the size of San Francisco. How many people who've traveled to the Netherlands got past Amsterdam, so other parts of the country? Great. I'll maybe go to you later for geography assistance, so keep this in mind. Well, when the war broke out in September of 1939, the Dutch government said, we're going to be neutral. Let the big boys fight it out. They were neutral during World War I and were left out of it, hoping for the same. But that's not going to be their choice. There's a major country on their eastern border, and you just see a little sliver of it. It's called Germany. And they're making the choices of who we're going to leave neutral for now and who not. It is now spring 1940. The Germans are on their major offensive in northern and western Europe, with more parts of Europe to come. And Holland is on the list. And in the wee hours of May 10th, 1940, German forces come over the eastern border and they start attacking. Well, the Dutch had forces in place, tried to put up a fight. They're not going to last that long, though. In fact, by the way, mighty France, who's right there, comes under attack, will surrender, don't remind the French this, in basically 6 weeks. Little Holland, who pretty much ends up fighting on its own, surrenders in less than 1 week. By the way, as I've been on this journey, occasionally I've had people in my audience. There were children in the Netherlands at this time. 3 years ago, I was hosted at the Dutch consulate in San Francisco. either former consul general Hugo von Meinfeld, and that's the only audience they ever had that two-thirds were Dutch heritage or Dutch people. They're all yelling out 5 days before I could finish the question because they remember like it was yesterday because the scars run deep. By the end of the week, the Netherlands has surrendered. And by the way, the day before the official surrender came, the government leaders and the royalty had a ship waiting for them that took them across the North Sea to the other side to London, England. And they will be a government in exile for the rest of the war. Good luck, Dutch people! And when the surrender came and the Germans said, ah, thanks for that, there was a little miscommunication. They had made a threat that if you don't surrender, we'll start bombing, and they did. Major city just south of Amsterdam, Rotterdam, got bombed to smithereens. By the way, those who traveled the Netherlands, did you go visit Rotterdam? Not many tourists do. And one of them did, yes, yes. It looks very different today. It's a rebuilt, modern, almost dull American-looking city rather than the beautiful historic cities of throughout Europe like Amsterdam. Well, a new day begins in the Netherlands. And as we go to the next slide to just talk about what was this Nazi occupation of Holland like, two words summarize it quite well. Oppressive and brutal. And this occupation will last 5 miserable years. The worst and longest of all the countries in Western Europe, and each year will be worse than the one before it. And when I say oppressive and brutal, for instance, freedom of speech. You want to speak out against the government authorities, how they're running the country? You will be arrested if not tortured and beaten. Freedom of press. Nazi censorship takes over the newspapers, and the other, of course, major form of communication, getting news in those days, the radio. Before 1940 is out, they order the Dutch citizens, don't listen to your radio. And as the war is going on, the Germans think a lot of people are ignoring that order. And if you are, you start picking up secret broadcasts coming out of London, the BBC. Radio Orange, the Dutch government in exile, sets up its own radio station, and sometimes the Queen will come on to broadcast. And if you were listening to those secret broadcasts by mid-1943, what you'd be hearing was very different than a year and a half before when Germany was dominating the whole continent of Europe. You would be starting to hear that they're starting to suffer defeats on the battlefield. The Germans don't want people to know this. You don't want to give them hope. September 1943, the German authorities in the Netherlands ordered the Dutch citizens, turn in your radios. They conduct raids on houses to get radios. Most of the people just went along and followed the rules. When that order came, Franz Weinacker, he hit his radio. He didn't go along. Franz was not a guy that just naturally followed rules. Keep that in mind. And in time, here's what scared the Dutch a lot. The term for it was called forced labor, meaning this. The Germans are suffering a labor shortage. They don't have enough able-bodied men, let alone women, to work the factories and fields to support this huge war machine they've got. By the way, where were those people? Why weren't they there to do those jobs? They're running all those concentration camps, plus the thing we call World War II. They had over 10 million soldiers involved in that, too. So how did they make up for the labor shortage? They took people from the countries they occupied and said, you come work in Germany. The Netherlands right next door, very convenient. During the course of the war, 350,000 Dutch citizens went into forced labor. They went to work in Germany. 30,000 don't come home alive when this is over. Some came home disabled. Once the Dutch figured out what this was, no, thank you, that's not a job I want. Later in the war, Franz Weinacker got notice. You go report first to medical evaluation and then on to work in Germany. A major obstacle he has to overcome. Well, in time, you start to see some resistance efforts from the Dutch. Major protests. Don't get involved because the Germans' response, force and execution. And in particular, when you started to see these handful of real core resistance groups doing dangerous activities like sabotage, hit-and-run attacks. Don't be in my neighborhood, because the reprisals were always on anybody else. For instance, if you go today in the neighborhood in Amsterdam called Apollo Lawn, and I can remember visiting there a few years ago, you will see a statue in a very nice area of 3 resistance fighters. And what they represent is what happened on that spot in October of 1944. They had hit one of the Germans. When the head of the SS operations had heard that, he ordered in that neighborhood people to come out and watch, and they rounded up 29 people and executed them on that spot. That's what that statue represents. And basically, that reign of terror already got its beginnings in 1943. The last half of the war, 2-plus years in the Netherlands, you had this constant reign of terror by the Germans and the Dutch helpers that made life so difficult. This was life in the Netherlands. where Franz and Yvonne Ocker lived. Not a pleasant place. Well, the number one priority for the German authorities in running this country was this. Persecute, isolate, and deport the entire Jewish population they could get their hands on to the death camps in Poland. Well, the Jewish population in the Netherlands prior to the occupation was approximately 1.5% of the total. Now, this doesn't happen all at once, but it starts to build up even before 1940s out. Edicts come out targeting the Jewish population. And here was one of the early ones. All Jews in the Netherlands, if you work in university positions like professors or in government jobs, you're now out of that job because you're a Jew. Now, only a handful of Dutch Jews had achieved these positions of prominence at this point in time. But among the most prominent Jews in the country affected by the edict was a man named Lodewijk Visser. And his job in the Netherlands then was equivalent to the job that John Roberts has in our country today. What's he do? That's right. Our Chief Justice of the American Supreme Court, Lodewijk Visser, had an equivalent role in the Dutch High Court. By the end of November 1940, he was now out of that job because he was a Jew. And his fellow justices, in response, said, that's correct. Nothing's going to come from them. Green light, the Germans say. They won't care what we do with their Jews. Let's continue. And they do. And throughout all of 1941, edict after edict keeps coming out, targeting the Jewish population that by the end of the year, here was the effect. The Jewish population now has been isolated and removed from the non-Jewish population. Going to school with non-Jews, can't do. Attend university, Jews not allowed. Working with non-Jews, you're out of a job. Own your own business, it's been taken away. Go out and enjoy social recreational activities like anybody else. Jews are now prohibited. And by January 1942, a shift is beginning in the country. For the Jewish population not already living in Amsterdam, they're being taken from their homes and placed into Amsterdam, into ghettos. And by July 1942, the trains are cranking. And they're taking the Jewish population bit by bit from Amsterdam and shipping them off to the death camps in Poland, primarily Auschwitz and Sobibor. Now, the Nazis were masters of propaganda. So the message they told the whole population, Jewish and non-Jewish alike, was this. We're sending the Jews to work camps in Germany. False. And to reinforce that propaganda with some of those early arrivals to the death camps, when they got off the trains, if they survived the ride, they had postcards already filled out for them. All you had to do was sign your name. And this, in effect, was the message on the postcards. Dear friends and family, life at the camp, it's not so bad. Sure, you got to work. That isn't so bad. Food's decent. We look forward to seeing you soon. And that goes back to the people waiting anxiously in Amsterdam. I guess I don't need to worry after all. And this is just going to continue and continue and continue. And by the end of September 1943, the entire Jewish population the Nazi authorities could get their hands on had been deported. But the authorities had this inkling. I don't think we got them all. Now, if you were a Jew in the Netherlands at this time, most don't know what's happening. You get captured and then deported. But those who said, you know, I think doom's coming, your best hope, go into hiding. But you're going to need help. Would anybody help? Contrary to popular belief, the answer to that question is not many. Take guess what most of the Dutch population is doing during this period of oppression and brutality they're living under. What are most doing? That's it. Just trying to survive. I hope I can feed my family. I hope I don't get called into forced labor. Sorry. That's the vast majority of the population. By the way, some of those people do feel sympathetic because they notice their fellow Jews go away and they don't come back. But if you rang their doorbell and said, please help, they would not open their door. How come? They were very much afraid. Because if you get involved and the Nazi authorities find out you're helping hide people we're after, especially Jews, you get to go where we're sending the Jews to, concentration camps, where death waits you sooner or later. Even more so in Poland, we may execute you on the spot. Nah, thanks. Well, of the Dutch who play a role in this war, just a small percentage, approximately 2% or so of the population, you can put them in two groups. You notice my hands here. The one on the left means that's a little bit more than the one on the right. The one on the right, resistance. So I'll save them for last. The one on the left, the sympathizers and collaborators with the Nazis. One thing that gets overlooked, and it already began in the 1930s, and then when the war broke out and spreads throughout Europe, Adolf Hitler and his Nazi party go conquering throughout all of Europe. They had a lot of help in most every country from the locals, including the Netherlands. Prior to the war, the Dutch, as many places had, these little fascist Nazi parties were forming, including in the United States. The Dutch Nazi Party was known by its initials NSB. The Dutch viewed them as just kind of extremist idiots, maybe a few thousand prior to the war. Ignore those idiots. Now we're a year into the occupation. 100,000 people have now signed up and joined the NSB. They want to be on the winning team. The Germans look like they're going to conquer everything, control the world, join up. Great opportunities. You don't have the strict rationing that most of the population has. You get to keep your bicycle. You don't get called to forced labor. You get good jobs. You don't have to be qualified, just loyal. And by the way, there are people, I wasn't an NSB-er kind of people, but you could be sympathetic by just helping out. Call when you see something suspicious. Sure enough, the authorities find that those people are hiding, who were after, especially Jews, they paid bounties to people. Great way to make extra money during these very hard economic times. You sometimes had to worry as much about your fellow Dutch as you did about the Germans, especially if you were in the resistance. And when I talk about the resistance, here's what ends up happening for the Dutch in their resistance efforts. In time, about a half dozen groups will get formed. But here was one of their problems, and especially those who got in the dangerous work, you know, sabotage, hit-and-run attacks. For most of the war, they operated independently of one another. Most never had the manpower or firepower to ever keep up with the Germans. And the other problem for the Dutch, unlike other parts of Europe, so I'm going to go back to the people who've been there before, and you got past Amsterdam. Let me see your hands. There we go. Don't be afraid. It's okay. And geographically, you also had a disadvantage. See, in other parts of Europe, if you did some hit-and-run attack and you ran into those big mountain ranges, they can't find you. Deep into the forest, they can't find you. How many big mountain ranges and deep forests do you find in the Netherlands? How many? None. In fact, we'll go back for a second just to see the country map there for a moment. There we go. What you don't see on this map, most of this country is fairly flat, a little hilly in the south. Great for bike riding, best bike riding country in the world. And lots of water. In fact, the Dutch are the best water civil engineers in the world, otherwise half this country would be flooded. They've really learned how to master that. So if you're in one of these core resistance groups, and don't be in my neighborhood, I don't want the reprisals hitting us, the innocent, it was tough. And if you can hold your breath underwater a long time in the resistance, you'll do just fine. So what's happening to many of these resistance fighters? They get caught, arrested, imprisoned, deported to concentration camps, and even executed. Many of them had to go into hiding. Of all the resistance groups, the one that will become the most effective was known by its initials of L.O. Here's the full name in Dutch. Landelijke Organisatie voor Hoop en Onderduikers. English translation, the National Organization for Helping People in Hiding. During the course of the war, the LO will help hide from the German authorities 300,000 people. Quite effective. But by the time they had a real network operating around the country, it was mid-1943. Too late to help many of the Jews. At best, around 25,000 Jews make it into hiding. But here was the problem for them. They're the number one target. Over a third of them will get caught and deported. So those non-Jews willing to get involved in this risky, dangerous business of helping hide people from the authorities, you had far more non-Jews willing to help hide non-Jews. Trying to help hide a Jew, I don't know if I want to go that far. Franz Amin Weinacher, they went that far. And we'll jump ahead a couple of slides, one more. There we go, back to the book cover for a moment, because I want you to understand the meaning of this title as I'm about to introduce you to Franz Amin Weinacher. And again, you see the title, Two Among the Righteous Few, subtitle, A Story of Courage in the Holocaust. Well, the key word in that title is the word righteous. And it comes from a place called, next slide please, Yad Vashem. How many people have heard of the place? Oh, good, good. And of those who've heard of, how many have been there? Ah, okay. Well, go to, for those who've been there, tell me what it is and where. What is it and where is it? It is in Jerusalem, Israel. Very good. All right. Very good. Well, not in the museum, but in Jerusalem, right? Okay. And then I just gave it away. And it's a museum dedicated to what subject? That's right. This is, and the one in U.S. and in D.C., the U.S. Holocaust Museum, they have this competition, who's the most prominent one today. This is the first of its kind when it was formed in 1953. The word Holocaust was not yet part of our English vocabulary.
You are listening to the Commonwealth Club of California. Listen to thousands of our podcasts on iTunes or Google Play. And when you're in the Bay Area, please join us live for one of our 450 programs each year. You can find us online at commonwealthclub.org. And now, back to our program.
I have been there three times myself over the years, and it's greatly expanded over time. It's very educational, very moving about the Holocaust, but the thing that already stood out to me most, and including I was just there last May a year ago, is who comes to visit? People from around the world visit this museum every day, not just people who live in Israel. Well, there's a department within Yad Vashem's work, and they even have a little section in the big museum about it. It's called, next slide please, Righteous Among the Nations. And that's where the word righteous comes from in the book title. And this is actually an honor. If you've earned the criteria to get that honor, it's an honor that goes to the non-Jews who during the course of the Holocaust risked their own lives to try to help save the lives of Jews. You notice the title of the book is not Two Among the Righteous Many. It was not a lot who did this. Well, among one of the early honorees that some of you, I think many of you may have heard of, thanks to the movies as well, 1993 Academy Award-winning movie was in honor of Oscar Schindler. Well, as we go to the next slide, and what you see when it says Avenue of the Righteous, this connects, because this is what you, when you walk the grounds, you're going to see plaques and trees planted for people who've gotten this heroic honor of righteous among the nations, which they call the Avenue of the Righteous. And that's the plaque to Franz. Her full name was Hermina, mean for short, and she wasn't. Franz and Hermina Weinacher are two Oscar Schindlers. When this honor came in their lives, it was August of 1983. Mean, the wife, had already passed away. She died in 1980, so never knew about it. Franz, the husband, was still alive to receive the honor, and he lived to 1994, almost the age of 86. So I'm going to tell you about who they were and what they end up doing that later earns this heroic honor. And we'll go to the next slide to take you back into their country, the Netherlands. And you see the red arrow here in southeastern Netherlands. It's pointing to where they lived. They lived in a small town named Dieden, in basically a countryside area. Small towns, little villages, where most of the rest of the country is cities large and small. And life for them in this area, typical of most people in the area, was basically three things that were important. One, they wanted to raise a family. And this young married couple, by the end of 1942, already had four small children under the age of five. Yes, parents in the room, that thought will make you cringe. But hey, we want more kids too. Second, they believed in the work ethic, work hard. And they lived the traditional roles of the time period of the 1940s. Mean is the woman, you run the household. Oh, she ran it. Franz is the husband, you work to support your family. He worked at a grain mill one town over from Dieden. Were they well off? No. Was anybody in the area well off? Not really. But they got by, they could feed their family, they were okay. And the last thing that was important for them in this area, be good Catholics. In other parts of Europe, be in other parts of the country, be good Protestants. In those days of the 1940s, very different than in 2017 throughout much of Western Europe, the role of the church, regardless of what Christian faith, very influential. And not surprising in their area then, who's the number one authority figure everyone reveres? The local parish priest. And what he tells you to do, you do. And when he says, don't do it, don't do it. And be at church every Sunday. That was their lives. Pretty ordinary people. But they weren't. After the war broke out, Franz took a leave of absence from his job at the mill. And he thought he could make a little bit more money by getting meat and eggs from farmers in the countryside near where he lived, and then he would travel on the train to the major cities in the West, capital of The Hague, Amsterdam, and he's selling this food to people in the city. This food is very scarce in the country. The Germans have taken much of it away off to Germany. This is what you call a black market business, which means it's not. That's right, don't get caught. And he was a good salesman doing it. Spring 1943, Franz was on one of these business trips in Amsterdam. And he calls upon this doctor acquaintance he's done business with before. And before he leaves the meeting with the doctor turns to him and says, would you be willing to help? And the doctor explains, you see, we've got this young girl hiding here in the city of Amsterdam, and we'd love to get her out to the countryside where you live. Well, what's your town again? Franz says, Dieden. Yes, let's say you take her out to Dieden for 3 weeks. That way she could get a little better fresh air and a little better food. Oh, and by the way, she's Jewish. So would you be willing to help? And this was Franz's response. Okay. Not exactly knowing what he's getting into, but he's a helpful guy and you've asked for his help, so sure. So he's going to meet this young girl before the night is out. He only knows her by her false Dutch name, Freitje. He thinks she's small in stature, that maybe she's 12. She's actually 14, not far from her 15th birthday. By the way, you don't sneak somebody out of the cities during the day. Too many Germans around, NSBers around, suspicious people. You go out late at night. Franz will get Freitje out of Amsterdam and finally home to Dieden around midnight. By the way, there were no cell phones in those days. So when he's not home by supper time as he normally would have been, take a guess what his wife, Mien, was thinking and feeling. Yes, and did he get arrested for this black market business? Is he sitting in jail somewhere? I'm not going to sleep tonight. And then finally around midnight, he shows up unexpectedly with this young girl, and he says briefly to his wife, we're going to have this young girl stay with us here for 3 weeks. And this was Mien's response. Well, it's late. Let's get her to bed. Whew. He dodged a bullet there. And a new business has just begun for Franz and Mien Weinacher. Well, after Freitje had been there for a week, Mien comes to Franz one day. You know, Franz, I've been speaking with Freitje, and you know what I think I've learned? I think she's Jewish. Did you know that? Franz said, yeah, I knew. Well, she's got a younger brother still hiding in Amsterdam. Go get him. And out in the train, Franz will go, and they're going to sneak out her younger brother and call him Freitje. And before long, through these two former teachers in Amsterdam, through various acquaintances, that heard about this Franz Weinacher guy in the countryside. They come out in the train with a girl of 17 who happens to be Jewish. And they bring her to the home of Franz and Mien Weinacher. Say, sure, we'll take her in. Now there's three Jewish children refugees in their own home with their four little children. Do they recognize what they've gotten into? Maybe not fully yet. And the consequences, as we already said, very deadly and dangerous, but they're going to continue anyway. And then comes the pivotal moment. Stranger shows up on Franz's doorstep one day and starts talking to him right away. And he only goes by this code name, Long John. And initially, as he's talking to Franz, he's making him nervous. Because this Long John fellow seems to know that Franz and Mien Weinacher have three Jewish children, refugees, in their own home. So Franz is wondering to himself, how does this guy know this? Is he a spy? Is he with the police to arrest me? And then this Long John fellow says this, you could be of help to us. Who is this guy? He's with the LO, the resistance group that helps people hide. Likely the Dr. Quaintance in Amsterdam, also part of the LO. Franz Weinacher, helpful guy, countryside, good location. Let's see if we can get more help from him. So now Long John starts to explain, and Mien has joined Franz for the conversation. And he tells them, we're trying to get the remaining Jews still hiding in the cities out before it's too late. Now, certainly, you can't fit them all in your own home. But here's what we'd like you to do if you're willing. We can give you money to fund an operation. And we'd like you to go around the little towns in your area and see if you can recruit people to take somebody in their home, and then you can pay them for it. Now, I don't want to kid you, he says. This would be risky, and this would be dangerous, but would you be willing to help? And Franz and Mien look at each other, and without hesitation went, okay! Not necessarily understanding fully what they're signing up for, but they want to be helpful. And now they go forward, and this takes over their whole life, day in and day out. Franz gets word of people coming out or to go in the cities and sneaking them out. He's going around the local areas recruiting. And he was a good salesman doing it. He would appeal, you know, the good Lord would look to help. And by the way, people can be put on less and could be forced in your home. I can get you someone, and I can pay you for it. And he's getting people placed. And all the people he was placing, from children to adults of various ages, were all Jewish. But as this picked up, so did the many challenges and dangers. And when I reflect back on the many challenges and dangers that Franz will encounter with Mien right there in support, I am stunned that they actually persisted. Most people would have quit. I got four little children to worry about, too dangerous, go away. But they won't. And among the many challenges and dangers they encounter, I'm just going to highlight two briefly. One, the term you'd hear for it is betrayed, meaning this. In this network that Franz had built, sometimes he'd hear people calling for him, Franz, you got to come. Franz, this Jewish person we had here, got exposed. That means word will travel to the authorities shortly, which means, Franz, not only are they going to come get this person, they're going to come get us. We've been betrayed. Get them out of here. And Franz could not convince those people to keep the Jewish individual any longer. Mad scramble, try to find another place. At the height of this, Franz and Mean often had 8 to 10 Jewish refugees in their own home with their 4 little children, one crowded place. And the second among many challenges and dangers they encountered, that I'll highlight briefly, deals with the first adults that Franz and Mean took in their own home after the 3 children. It was a young married couple, an architect and his wife, were able to sneak out of Amsterdam and come to the Weinacher home in the fall of 1943. And after settling in there, the wife had a secret she couldn't keep secret any longer. She was already pregnant. How do you have a baby born to a Jewish woman in Nazi-occupied Holland? Basically, impossible! Well, when this was finally over, and this didn't go on for just 2 days or 2 weeks or even 2 months, this went on for nearly 2 years. Franz, with the support of his wife, Mean, will help save the lives of over 2 dozen Jews from certain death, and miraculously, nobody will be caught. As we see the next slide, you can see why later they earn that honor of righteous among the nations. Now, the last thing that I'll cover before I open up the floor to your questions deals with my own meaningful personal connection to the story and its heroes, and I'm going to read you a little excerpt from the book about it. And Carol, if you, I think she's coming in. I'm going to introduce you something to set up. There she is, right on schedule. As I've been on this journey, unexpected journey, six years into it, I've had a wonderful supporter helping me along the way, and I brought her with me here tonight. It is my wife, Leah Bars, and here she is. There's your, yeah, you can, yes, yes, thank you. Charlie, make sure you're clapping. That helps me at home. All right, very good. Now, my wife, Leah, and her family were actually immigrants from the Netherlands themselves. They moved to the United States when she was in the 8th grade to a place called Los Angeles. Much better weather than the Netherlands. And after settling in there, she goes on to high school, for anyone who knows Los Angeles, graduate of Fairfax High School. And then she goes on to university and graduates from a place called UCLA. And then she starts a career as a teacher down in Los Angeles. After a few years, she moved to Northern California to a place called San Francisco. And she has a fine career. She continues in education, the bulk of it as a school psychologist, happily retired today, as she reminds me about often. And she raises 2 daughters along the way, doing fine in their lives today. Later in life, she picked me up. And as she always tells me, and I believe what I'm told, it's now been a little over 10 years of wedded bliss. Very good, very good. Thank you. All right. May 2009. At that point in my wife Leah's life, it has been 25 years since she was back to her original homeland of the Netherlands. And there's nobody left anymore in terms of friends or family but a burning desire to go back to her original homeland. And I had never been before at that point. So we plan a special trip and we go for 6 weeks. We're traveling around the country having a wonderful time. And then we stumbled into something by accident that I thought was so significant, I end up writing a letter to her 2 daughters, Shoshana and Alana, and that's the piece I'm going to read to you now. One last thing before I do. If you knew my wife as a child in the Netherlands, less would you know her by her name Leah, and much more by her Dutch nickname Ineke, so please keep that in mind. Chapter 1, Historic Moment. Dear Shoshana and Alana, today is Tuesday, May 26, 2009. I'm writing to share more than just travel stories from a wonderful journey your mom and I are having. I want to document something to you that I hope you'll find of much value for your own family history. Well, I know some of the history, and you probably do too. Coming in contact with the reality of it merges mind and heart into something of great significance. I will explain shortly. Being in the Netherlands, much more than in the United States, one is reminded of World War II and the Holocaust as well. When we started our trip in Amsterdam, we visited the Anne Frank House. It is a wonderful educational museum. Last Friday, we visited the museum and site of Camp Westerbork. Before World War II, there were 140,000 Jews who lived in the Netherlands. Over 75% perished during the Holocaust. Westerbork was the deportation the Nazis used, deportation center, the Nazis used to ship the Dutch Jews off to the death camps in Poland. We arrived last evening in the city of Eindhoven in the south of the country. Of the places your mom's family lived prior to immigrating to the U.S., Eindhoven was where they were the longest. Before arriving there yesterday, we stopped in an old town named Ravenstein. It is the big small town in an area of villages in a southern section of the country. It is also near where your grandparents were hidden during the war. As we stop and walk around the charming 1600s historic downtown of Ravenstein, all two blocks of it, we spot a tourist information office. We go in, and your mom asks the staff members about the location of, next slide please, of an old church, and you see it there, this big old vacant church, about a location of an old church in the nearby small town of Dieden, and if the home that once belonged to a Franz Weinacher is still next to it. For the older folks of this area, which the three office people on hand were, the name of Franz Weinacher is a notable one. They tell your mom not only how to get to this church, but also that one of the Weinacher sons still lives in this particular house. So off we go down the road to Dieden. About 10 minutes later, we find the church in question. We park our car there and walk over to the house next door. As we walk up the driveway, we see a few people sitting at a table in the front yard on this warm day, and we see, next slide please, and we see the word Shalom written on the front side of the house, probably a foot in size. Your mom boldly walks up to the gentleman sitting there and says in Dutch, "Hello, I'm Ineke Bars." A roar goes up along with a warm handshake. This man and his wife sitting with him know who Ineke Bars is and much more the significance related to her. In the next few minutes, the Dutch starts flying and phone calls start happening. Within 10 minutes, his youngest sibling, Irene, drives over and joins in the lively discussion, which, by the way, was all in Dutch, so I could only watch. The man who has greeted us is Franz Weinacher Jr. He is the youngest son of the aforementioned Franz Weinacher. His father, Franz, with the support of his mother, Mien, saved your grandparents and your mom, baby Ineke, during World War II. They all survived the Holocaust because this Catholic man and his wife hid them and other Jews and helped even more hide from the Nazis. Do you recognize the significance of this moment? Franz, the son, and his wife, also named Irene, visited Israel themselves last year. They showed us a blown-up picture of the memorial plaque entry planted in Yad Vashem's Avenue of the Righteous section in honor of their parents, which is when the historic significance of what I was witnessing really hit me. After visiting for over an hour, they've invited us to come back Wednesday evening. They have three other siblings who are all alive and living in the local area, so your mom will likely meet more of the Weinacher family who she last saw 25 years ago. Thank you for the oohs and ahs. Yeah, no applause would be fine. And we'll take a few minutes. We can get some questions in here. So what can I answer for people? And you've got a mic you can use with them. All right, he'll be my Phil Donahue here. Let me start with this question here. I always like to make sure we get this one on the table. And if we, what is your name?
Shelley,
if you would, please.
I have to wear glasses
to read. Oh, all right. Didn't catch you. That's all right.
Take Unless somebody can read it for me.
All right, there we go. Someone more prepared.
No problem.
Sorry about that. All right, Robin, okay.
So what happened when you came back for that visit with the family that Wednesday?
Ah, good question, Robin. And I know you were thinking about it anyway, Shelley. Yes, yes, yes. All right. Yes. Well, that's how I just finished this piece here in terms of and I always like to answer this question by putting the lives of people here today, right here in the San Francisco Bay Area. You know, we had shown up unexpectedly. And let's say you had a brother or sister in the area one night, gives you a call and says, so-and-so just came into town. I think it was like 25 years ago we last saw her. Oh, yeah, I remember. She's here with her husband. Okay, could you come over tomorrow night to visit with them? Here's the answer so many people I know. It would go like this. Oh, I wish I could, but I have this happening with work or this happening with the kids or these days, technology toys to absorb my attention. Sorry, send them my regards. Well, when the Weinacher siblings heard, and there's five of them today, youngest was born after the war, when they heard, and they think of my wife more by her nickname Ineke, when they heard Ineke Bars was in town, please show the last slide, all five came that evening. This was a very special and happy reunion. And what was interesting about this reunion that night, for those who've traveled in the Netherlands, you know, vast majority of the Dutch speak multiple languages, especially English. They, in that picture, in their 60s, 70s, grew up in the countryside, they don't speak much English, and I speak even less Dutch. That whole night, the conversation was in Dutch, and we were there for 3 hours. I did not feel out of place. It was just neat to watch a very happy reunion going on with my wife and the Weinacher siblings, who were so happy to see her. What's been interesting on our journey? We have now had travels since in Europe. The last time, May of last year, three other occasions where we came into the Netherlands, and Nelly on the far right, and this is a picture that's in the book, Nelly on the far right, who was our point person with the family that helped in this story, she always said, you come stay with us. So we have now spent more time with her, her brothers and sisters, and with her children and grandchildren as well. So we feel very fortunate for the reconnection to the Weinacher. So thank you for your question. Yes, so got a question.
How did they survive the war, and how did your wife and her family leave? How did they get out?
All right. So how did her and the family get out after the war?
Well, and how did the rescuing family survive?
All right. We got two questions there. We'll start with the survival of the Weinachers and all the people they helped. You could answer it in simply good fortune. They have lots of close calls and lots of dangers and risks that they're running into. And what always stuns me is that in this two-year period, Franz and Mien right there with him never backed away. They just seemed to the people they helped, they just said they're selfless, and they just always seemed to be in control. So they worked through it, and they're able to survive, and they got some support from the LO with some money and could feed enough people and take care of them. Once the war is finally over and liberation finally comes, everybody disperses. And my wife's parents stayed in the Netherlands for a period of about 12 years. Her father worked as an architect for Philips Industries, which got them into Eindhoven, a major multinational company still today. And then they immigrated to the United States, where they continued to raise their children and lived a full life and retired as a good career. But that's kind of what happened to everybody. They just went their own way if you survived. It was not easy, certainly. Thank you for that question.
So I'd like to remind our audience that they're listening to Marty Brownstein speaking about Two Among the Righteous Few, a story of the Holocaust, and time for more questions.
All right, Shelley here.
Yes, hi.
This one you won't
if
need
you
glasses
give me
for.
Another one, I'd be able
yeah, all right, well, hold on, we might.
Most reading teachers are not illiterate, just blind. So I have read Miep Gies's book twice, and I'm blanking on the name of her wonderful book. Do you know?
I don't remember the book. I know what it'd be about. Obviously, she was involved with the Diary of Anne Frank.
Yes, she was
one of the helpers.
Dutch woman who attempted. She and her husband attempted to save the Franks,
and are recognized as righteous among the nations as well.
Mm-hmm. And were they a member of this organization
of the
whose
LO?
Name I didn't know, the LO? To your knowledge? I mean, I could...
Not to my knowledge, mm-hmm. But it isn't that they couldn't be.
Uh-huh.
The resistance group that
I'm
hid people.
Yeah, because that's the only book I've read about
yes,
this
Their actions
topic.
Were more very local there, trying to help the Franks and the other family that was with them hide up in the attic of an office building. And unfortunately, they got caught.
Right.
Luckily for Freitje, the first one they took into hiding, by the way, one of her girlfriends, where she lived in Amsterdam, was a girl named Anne Frank. But luckily, she got out of the city because she met a guy named Franz Weinacher. The chance of you surviving in the major cities with so many people around, and the Germans and the NSBers, not good. Countryside, much better. Great, thank you. We'll take a couple more here before we do a wrap up, right up front.
I was wondering if you found any common traits with people who did this sort of thing?
Wonderful question. A talk I sometimes do on occasion, and in fact the Commonwealth Club hosted me on this talk 3 years ago, is called The Righteous Heroes of the Holocaust. So on this journey I continue to study, and there are others like Franz and Mien. There's been some research done on some about were there things in common. Certainly not in background. All walks of life, well off, not well off. But there were some commonalities that many shared in terms of character. And when I think about those qualities, and I'll highlight a few, Franz and Mien fit them very well. One quality. And this one, if I could sprinkle it on people in 2017, it would become their behavior. I would sprinkle it right away. Compassion. The ability to care for others beyond yourself. Another one was that willingness to take risk. And a desire to really want to help and make a difference. And another one was, and then many of them I could tell stories all night long, because some of these people, and it happened for Franz and Mien as well, calm under pressure. Great qualities to have even today in just regular life. Interesting, when I take this into schools where we do book discussion, we were at a school last Friday right here in the city, and in workplaces where I add the discussion about how do you apply this to your life today, take away the life and death aspects, we talk about just the lessons and the calm under pressure and this compassion and this willingness to help are all very good qualities that make a difference just for our lives today. Luckily, these people had those qualities unfortunately, it wasn't enough. Thank you. And we had a question in the back, and then we'll come up front
here. Do you happen to know whether they've connected with other people that they've saved so that you could all get together and...
Yeah, from what we knew, and Nellie there, the oldest, who was our point person, there was a few they had some contact over the years. And as we were going back to put together the book, and they gave us a lot of information, they had even a little self-published Dutch book that they gave us that built into this. She said, most of our people, as far as we know, that our parents helped, are not alive. But one we know for certain, and they put us in touch with her, Freytje. Remember who Freytje was? Yeah, the very first person they took into hiding, this young teen girl. We've had a chance, and we're still in touch with her today. In late April 2010, one of the pictures we have in the book, her real name, Shula Schwartz, lives in Haifa, Israel, and we spent time with her, and boy, did she have memories. As a teenager, you remember these things. Neat thing is, again, we're still in touch with her. Wonderful lady, has had a full life. We were back in Israel this past May, prior to coming into the Netherlands. We got to hand Shula Schwartz her birthday card for her 88th birthday. And she's still very vibrant, very well off, health-wise, sharp as a tack, and just a warm, wonderful lady. She had a wonderful 50-year marriage, unfortunately a widow today, 3 children, 13 grandchildren, and here's a change from the first edition to the second edition of the book. At this first edition, she had 1 great-grandchild today, and we met a couple of them, 3 great-grandchildren. Thank goodness she met a guy named Franz Weinacher, that's for sure. And we got a question here. Gary.
Yeah, putting yourself at risk is one thing, but I'm curious, what would the fate of the children had been had they been caught, and yes. How did that factor into their decisions?
Yes, yes. Well, interesting, in terms of the second half, how did it factor into the decision? It didn't. They're just going to do it. If you got caught, sometimes, whole families got taken away. You were putting your kids in risk. The advantage they had was their children were young, so they really weren't yet at school till near the end. And for kids who were older, 7th grade, 8th grade, high school, if your family was involved in this, and this is many cases, when you went to school, you had the biggest secret in the world you could never tell. It only takes one person to betray you. So it is risky, and sometimes, yes, children got affected if families got caught sometimes. You put them in danger. For the Weinacher siblings, for them, as all little kids who have different vague memories, more memories from later on from the stories their father would tell, it was just exciting. Like, there's always this commotion and activity in the house. In fact, Nellie told us, where I learned table manners as a kid? It wasn't from my parents. It was from Freytje. She was like a built-in babysitter. She's a teen. They're little kids, so they loved her. So it worked out, thank goodness. But, yeah, there's risk. Great risk. Great question. Any others before we go to a final one? All right, we got a few more there. Are we okay on time just to keep questions going? Fantastic. Yeah, go ahead.
Thank you, Marty, for coming.
Yeah, thank you.
This past year, 2016, at the Castro Festival, Jewish Film Festival, I saw a documentary called The Last Laugh. And the Jews have a great sense of humor. We all know that. And how they survived the concentration camps is amazing. But one of the points they made was they survived because they had a great sense of humor and they shared their food and all of that. Is your book have any humorous arc to it? Is there?
Well, I'll answer it two ways.
Okay.
One is one of those, read more about it and make your own decisions. But there are things about Franz in particular that people sometimes do find humorous. So, while the intent of the story isn't humorous, the character, especially Franz, we've had some people say, wow, I had somebody as we're potentially hoping one day to get this into a movie who kind of evaluated on its movie potential and said, what a great character whoever gets to play Franz Weinacher. He was a wonderful storyteller and a man who was very creative. But, it's one of those you have to decide for yourself on that one. Yes?
I know that the Jewish people honor those that helped Jews escape by calling them the righteous. Did that couple receive that honor from
yes.
the Jewish people?
Yes, as I mentioned earlier and I showed the plaque, they are righteous among the nations, like an Oscar Schindler. So
and
they have gotten that honor.
And that's why you chose that for the title?
But yes, that's why that is all part of there. Yep. And this gentleman here.
So every person that Franz approached to ask them to help, that was a possible point of exposure.
And betrayal.
Were there any that said no and then he had to worry about them? Or were there any that, I mean, what?
Great question. Here's what helped in the local area where they live. And in time, he learns about being more careful. A little naive in the beginning. And some people, no, they're not going to help. But the area was primarily anti-German. Not many, if any, NSBers, the Dutch Nazis, around. And people in that era, especially in their area, didn't travel. Few cars. This Franz Weinacher guy going on the train, selling the meat and eggs, you know, he was some real character. But if anybody came in, and even though, by the way, if you've ever lived in a small town area, which is where they lived, guess what people like to do?
Talk.
And they call it gossip. They were a subject of a lot of gossip of people who don't know what's going on. But the good news is if anybody came into the area, which was usually by train, and you got off at the train station in Ravenstein, the big small town of the area, and you weren't from the area, you just stood out. Them city folk are just different. And then you stay quiet. So luckily, through good fortune, they don't get betrayed. But there is going to be some close calls. And there are some people in the local area they're going to need to worry about that are constantly a threat or a thorn. So it won't be easy. Definitely not. Any other questions? Yes, go ahead.
This tale reminds me of The Zookeeper's Wife, which has actually been made into a film.
Coming
so I
shortly,
say
yes.
Go for it with the film
idea.
Thank
you.
But
financing and producers, will you please give me a call here. We have some trying to help now.
My question is, do you see some very unsettling parallels between this aspect of history you have been studying and the present day here?
Uh-huh. and what is your name, by the way? No, what is your name?
Patricia.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, it's interesting that you asked that. I'll answer it this way. In the last, starting last summer, since then I've been speaking on it, I have a lot of people that raise that. You know, I won't answer it as a yes or no. Some people are seeing those things. I get told this now more in the last 9 months than ever in this 6-year period. We need to hear more stories like this. Be reminded of the good that people did in times of evil, even more in the contentious, polarized area that we lived. I was in a church in Chicago in July, and the pastor hosting me at his church started off this way. And this was before the election's over yet, but we already in the summer, it was at the height of, you know, lots of tension. And he said, in this growing divisiveness in our country and extremism around the world, we need to hear stories about people who do right, people who do positive things. That's what our speaker's going to talk to you about tonight. What a wonderful introduction before he introduced me. So people do, I'll just answer how people, some say yes, they do see some perils. In some cases, there are a lot of differences too. But it is challenging times for many, no doubt.
You mentioned earlier on in the talk that the local people in this village listened to the parish priest. Did the parish priest get involved in this process at all? And did he tell Franz who he could rely on or anything like that?
Wonderful question, George. Thank you. Let's play Jeopardy. You know, I give you the answer, you tell me the question. He was one of the biggest thorns to the rescue activity of Franz and Mien Weinacher. And the question is?
Who was the parish priest?
Not the Pope.
Who was the parish priest?
Who was the parish priest? Yes, yes. The Pope may be some there. Yeah, the Pope was not necessarily a lot of help either, but he wasn't in there.
That's a bigger issue.
Yes. The parish priest, Father Simons. Mm-hmm. He has to know all that's going on, and through gossip, he picks up something's going on, and he'll confront Franz. Mm-hmm. You don't lie to the parish priest.
Right.
Franz will admit what he's doing, but he never backs away. And even though the parish priest thought this was terrible, how can you do this? Why would you bother? He still will continue. So the good news about the parish priest, he doesn't betray them. He won't betray his parishioner. The other good news about him, luckily the Germans never came and interrogated him. He might have sang like a canary.
Yeah.
As a little side note I always like to tell, we've had a... On a subsequent visit to this May 2009 accidental visit, and we stayed with Nellie for a few days, and she says, here, take my car and drive in the local area, see some of the towns you talk about in the book. And we said, well, we want to go pay our respects to your parents. Where are they buried? They're a little Catholic cemetery in the town of Damon, one over from Dean. Here's how you get there. Okay. So there we have the nice gravestones of Franz and Hermina Weinacher. Who's buried one row over? Father Johannes Simons. So even in death, they couldn't get away from the storm. All right, let's get one final question here.
One final question?
All right. I want to make sure.
Someone have the glasses on?
All right. Pat and Joe can help it together.
What, What is it?
So whatever happened with that baby.
Yes. And I'm referring to the, it was this architect and his wife. She's already pregnant. That's the baby. Yeah, whatever happened. Yes. We always like to pull that together. Do you have an idea? That's why I'm glad you asked it. Thank you. Shelley, do you know? That's why we always want to bring it together. Well, I'll tell you what. Here's the short answer. Chapter 11, it explains the whole thing. You can leave it at that. Yeah. So thank you. But I'll at least give you a little bit more of an answer. It's been a little over 10 years ago that baby, I get to call my wife, and I brought her with me here tonight. Here she is, Leah Bars. When I say I have a very meaningful personal connection to the story and its heroes, it doesn't get any more meaningful and personal than this, folks. Yeah, thank you. Well, thank you. I knew about my wife's beginnings before we ever got married. But today, I understand the depth of it so much more. Franz and Mean Weinacher didn't have to do anything about this. What a huge dilemma. They can't take her parents and their mother to the local hospital and have the birth done there. The authorities know that. Would have been deported to a death camp right away. How do you get this done? Well, I'm not going to tell you how they pull it off, but I'll give you a little bit of just in brief. And this is the reminder. They performed a miracle. They got the baby born. They kept her and her parents safe until liberation finally came. And when you see Nellie up there at the far right, in a subsequent visit as we were getting ready to leave, with tears in her eyes, she hugged her very closely and said, "Doch, mein Orlok Zuster, goodbye, my war sister." She's a reminder to them of how proud they are of their parents. I say thank God for the courage and compassion of Franz and Mean Weinacher. Thank you all. Come visit with us here afterwards.
There couldn't be a better ending to another event at the Commonwealth Club in its 115-year history of enlightened discussion. Thank you very much for coming.